Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Fucking hooray!
Hey!
I joined in a bit.
Hey!
And why did you join in this time, Richard?
Well, Anthony, good throw forward there. I joined in because we have done 150 episodes of Spoiler-Filled Film Conversation. Hooray. And we're here to do a little retrospective. Maybe we'll catch some people up on old episodes they haven't heard, or we'll... Who am I kidding? We're just doing a retrospective because we thought, we've done 150, that's good, isn't it? Let's talk about them a bit and shine a few lights at the stuff that we think is good, bad and ugly. And, 150 seemed like a random enough number to pick. I'm Richard Nicholas, hello. With me to have this retrospective is Anthony Evans.
How do you do?
Good. And Jamie Thomas.
Yeah.
And Abigail Bain.
Hello.
Oh, we must be gentle because Abby's a little bit poorly, but is sticking with us despite having the lurgy.
150 episodes has been like a cancer eating for the last 15 years we've been doing this podcast.
What we've decided to do, seeing as normally we'd have the structure of all have watched a film and then discuss it at tedious lengths.
Now, tedious lengths.
Tedious lengths in a very Welsh accent. Isn't it, boyo? What we're going to do, we've got the top five best films we've reviewed, we've got the top five worst films we've reviewed, and just the top five favourite shows that we've done, and then just a free-for-all of thoughts, statistics and ideas that we'd like to talk about. And then you'll have some idea of the chaos that is Spoiler-Filled and what
this is for anyone who has somehow stumbled upon this absurdly named podcast on like iTunes or wherever. It's probably a good introduction because it stretches pretty far back.
Yeah.
And it gives a good feel for the shit that we talk that doesn't really the non-constructive bollocks that we spew into the abyss of the internet.
Yeah, well, why not? It's what all the cool kids are doing.
Yeah,
but
also
you know,
there's some. Do we how do the ratings on iTunes work? You know,
let's not worry ourselves because it will depress us. But people can review us on iTunes.
I meant explicit. Like when they give like a warning, like a content warning.
Oh, it should say explicit.
Okay, because looking back on the the archive, there's some pretty raunchy stuff that we've said.
Oh yeah, we talk about everything from bums to cunts, quite frankly, and everything in between.
Well, this isn't much.
The first kind of 100 or so shows are fairly sweary free.
They're lighter. They were light. There were a time where we had. In fact, now's a good time to mention it's not a great time, but we should mention we've had a few other people on the podcast. Stephen Lee started us off in episode one, slowly half did. He started off in episode one, and then he sort of lost interest, even though he bought one of the films to review it. He didn't end up on the toys review. And, you know, Stephen Lee stopped doing it, and our good friend Ollie Bain, he was doing it early on, and for him, we were a bit nicer to him. He just doesn't like the swears, so that's why we were less sweary at the start. And he left us, and we decided, you know what, I'm gonna say poop every now and again.
But also, yeah, I think there should be a disclaimer somewhere of, please be aware, we don't mean a lot of the things we say. It's said in jest, so like calling out. Yeah. Certain celebrities, maybe, or
saying horrible things about the mentally ill, or being racist by accident, like I have accidentally done. I'm just a character, okay? I don't genuinely, I genuinely can tell the difference between China and Japan. I just choose not to as a character. The character Rich, that's who's on the show.
The best part of that is I was just trying to do a catch-all, please don't be offended, we're just messing around, and immediately Rich got defensive about it.
Because, let's be honest, it's mostly Rich.
Look, we've all said things we can't take back or edit out, because I edit. Okay, We're four Welsh people. One of them lives in America. That's Jamie. So he's different now. He's American, basically. But three Welsh people and a sort of American chatting about films. That is the show. That's
I'm
all you
still
need to
Welsh.
Know. Whatever. You don't sound Welsh to me. Your accent's changed. You're all like, ah, oh, cheeseburger. Goddamn, Elvis Presley. You know, that's how you sound now. this is a good example of how never mind, enough examples of what the show is. We discuss usually mediocre films. We don't like to do blockbusters. We don't often like to do terrible, terrible films. But they slip through the net because they're fascinating. And now let's talk about some of the films we've previously reviewed on other podcasts and count them down. Right, guys?
Yeah!
On other podcasts, you mean other episodes of this podcast?
Yes, it's incredibly self-indulgent, yeah.
Yeah. Hooray!
Self-interested film conversation, hooray! Okay. I actually typed some crap here for the first time ever to quickly explain, so I wouldn't spend ages trying to articulate what the film's about, so forgive me if I sound a bit weird. I'm just reading my own terrible writing, okay?
Okay.
He also likes to put a voice on when he reads, so be ready for that.
Hello, I am...
Top 5 best films we've reviewed.
Hooray.
Hooray!
So already, we've got trouble, because our number 5 is a split entry due to admin problems. I'm sorry,
our number 5 are 5 or 6 best films.
We've got a tie. Tie for 5th already. It's not a great start, but...
Also, when we're talking about these films, like top 5, 6, whatever, best films we reviewed, is this technically the 5/6 only genuinely good films we've reviewed? Is that what the consensus is here?
There are other good films we've reviewed, but we don't do great films very often. So these are actually good films, usually.
Okay.
But yeah. The best
the cream of the crop.
The best we thought were cracking. Like, these are just, as a group, we recommend these films genuinely.
And also made good podcasts.
Of course. Yeah. They all made good podcasts.
Of course. I don't know why I had to say that.
Some of the technical difficulties on some are terrible, though, but forgive us.
Yeah.
This is going split swimmingly, guys. I haven't even done number 5 yet. And there's 2 number 5s, so...
Number 10.
Number 5/6. Strange Days from 1995. Ralph Fiennes is a futuristic black market dealer that peddles headgear that allows punters to quantum leap into other people's recorded memories. With help from the limo driver, Angela Bassett, they get embroiled in a grubby murder mystery. So.
Yes, I actually voted for this. So I am happy that it is there.
I've loved Blade Runner forever. Mm. And whenever I've mentioned it, someone's gone, oh, have you seen Strange Days? And I've gone, no. And they've gone... Because, like, for some reason, it's the logical progression, I guess, from Blade Runner to Strange Days.
But... I see it and I don't see it at the same time, because they're not about the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess
The
aesthetic is similar-ish.
Kind of. It's that cyberpunk type of thing. I would actually... Strange Days is more what I would think of as cyberpunk than... Blade Runner was one of the things that really kicked off the whole cyberpunk thing in the early 80s. So I think it's more that Strange Days wouldn't exist were it not for Blade Runner, and that's why people recommend it on the back of it.
Yeah, and I think we all kind of liked it, but it has got its weird moments and flaws and stuff.
Yeah, it's an interesting film. I think the most kind of outstanding bit of it was the kind of first person techniques that they use in there, which are very engrossing.
I mean, that's probably the best thing is, what's the director's name?
It's Catherine Bigelow.
Yeah, she manages to do a kind of first person video game style perspective where people relive memories, and that's great. And they use the concept in a really original way. I think at one point the mystery is unraveled because Ralph Fiennes feels the memories of a rapist raping someone, but then the rapist puts the headset on his victim so she can feel him rape her. And it's like this 3 levels of disgusting that you're just like, oh, that's crazy.
It's definitely one of the things that makes it stand out from the films that within the films that we've done, and generally, is that it was, for 95, it was fairly ahead of its time.
Mm.
And Abby, if I'm right in thinking, you're a fan of Angela Bassett, and this is one of the films she's actually in a bit, rather than the tiny cameos she usually ends up being.
Yeah.
She is in films, but of the ones I watched, I'm not their audience, to be fair, aren't very good.
Hmm. But still, she's a good actress.
She's excellent in this, though.
Kick-ass limo driver.
Yeah.
And here's a clip from the original podcast. Although, I don't know why it's called Strange Days.
I think there was, in one of the nightclubs, I think they had at some point a song with the lyric Strange Days in it. But that's the only kind of reference I can find.
The song in the movie is a cover of the song by The Doors. That seems to be it. That seems to be the entire...
I mean, what else could you have called it? Like, mind watch or like playback? Is that what they call doing the mind thing?
Yeah.
You know, what can we rate it as, really? I don't know. What piece of silly, redundant technology is it now?
Maybe something like, in terms of technology, something like hair curlers or something.
Right.
You break them out, you're all excited, and then you have...
Wait. Kind of you don't have hair curlers or curly hair. Why are you excited about hair curling?
Well, I'm guessing whoever's broken them out is excited to curl their hair. I don't
know. Roleplay, Rich. Get behind it.
I'm just curious why someone who's never had long curly hair would suddenly be like, it's like hair curlers.
I just couldn't think of anything else that you'd have to wait to use.
Okay.
Because you have to wait for them to heat up, and then... But then you just have to wait, and then you put them in, and it's like, oh, my hair's all curly. Let's go.
Right, good. In at number 5 again. Manhunter from 1986. William Peterson tries to stop a derpy-looking serial killer with the help from Hannibal the Cannibal, this time played by Brian Cox, not the science guy. It's super 80s, and a blind lady hugs a tiger.
Oh, yeah.
Best bit.
This was my pick, I think, if I remember right.
Yeah.
Because Silence of the Lambs is one of my favourite films, and I've always known Manhunter existed, and that Brian Cox played Hannibal Lecter, but for some reason never actually sat down and watched it. Mm. And I think I wanted to see, because there are so many sequels and prequels to Silence of the Lambs now because of its success. You know, it went on to Hannibal, then Red Dragon, which is a remake of this.
Yeah.
Then fucking whatever it's called, fucking Hannibal Begins. The one where he's young and his sister gets eaten. Hannibal Rising.
And then there's Hannibal the Holiday Camp, where he goes to... No, I can't, I'm sorry. We do discuss the Hannibal franchise throughout the original podcast, so let's stay away from discussing it again now. But that's a good reason to explore it.
I mean, Anthony Hopkins is synonymous with Hannibal Lecter, and I wanted to see someone else do it differently, but I didn't want to watch Hannibal Rising because it sounds like utter shit. So
we let Michael Mann steer the reins of the ship.
Yeah, and I like, you know, Michael Mann is... This was one of the earlier films, but he was known for Miami Vice... and then action later on, movies, bigger things like Heat. But I didn't realise how neon and 80s this film was. And I think the general consensus with all of us was the atmosphere was really nice. There's something strangely cosy about a serial killer film.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Because it's Brian Cox is so very comfortable in his cell. It's disquieting.
He's really nice. He's also socks on as well.
He's also a really good Hannibal Lecter, considering the standard hadn't been set at that point. Nobody had... Brian Cox is really good at Hannibal Lecter, considering at that point the standard hadn't been set by Anthony Hopkins. Mm. And I mean, Brian Cox doesn't have the menace, but he has a strange charisma to the... Like, he plays the part more odd than Anthony Hopkins did. Anthony Hopkins was a lot more sort of stately professor type.
But also sinister as well.
Yeah, whereas Brian Cox plays him as just this obviously intelligent oddball kind of character.
It's slightly aloof or something.
Yeah, and it's just interesting to see a different interpretation.
Yeah. Anthony, yourself, do you want to weigh in on how you felt about Manhunter?
Yeah, it's one of the podcasts that I wasn't present on.
That's true.
Which is a shame, because it is a really good film that I saw a long time ago. And but since then I've listened to the podcast and it's good. And the film is very, very 80s. It's got a very 80s synth soundtrack. And it's very typical Michael Mann fare. It's a good film.
I will say as well, it's probably a good film because now, I mean, it's been going on since sort of the early 2000s, but certainly now in 2016, that the throwback to that colourful, that bold coloured neon 80s aesthetic and that heavily synthesized music.
Hmm.
And also, if you only know Peter, William Peterson from CSI, then check this out. Because he's better.
he does some very good intensely staring at a window and talking to himself.
I would say the one thing that is a bit weird about this film is his character, not him so much. His character's a bit of an idiot because he's so into stopping the serial killer and thinking like a serial killer. He doesn't wait for the police backup. He just decides to smash through a window and tackle the villain. Just, going to get you with your strange tights on your head. And it's like, just, there's police. You could probably wait. I mean, time's of the essence, but maybe not head first through the window. Just a thought.
It did kind of forego the original ending of the book as well, where there's a sort of bit at the end where it turns out the serial killer's not dead and he comes back and attacks them. Oh. But it kind of made sense in this film.
Yeah. So anyway, you can check out the podcast or the film. Let's move on, guys. To keep this brisker than we're already doing, right? Let's do it. And here's a clip from the original show.
General rule for life, don't ever promise your wife you'll never do something again, because that means that you will.
Yeah, that's a guarantee that you will do it, especially if it's dangerous.
I have to leap headfirst into the mind of a serial killer and look around crime scenes to save people. It's like, oh, you have to save people. That's your clever get out. I'm glad Michael Mann had his hands on it because, you know, it's not. It's a manly film at times. He has moments where, oh, the main character must make love to his wife in an all blue lit room, and but it isn't overly men with guns running down streets and hard men talking. I think, you know, it's a little more lighter than Michael Mann usually is.
That might be another reason it suffered as well, is because it wasn't guns blazing, you know, from the director of Miami Vice kind of.
At the same time, it did feel like the same world. It seemed like an episode of Miami Vice that got a lot darker. Tubbs didn't come in at the end and say like something funny to make the episode end. What's the catchphrase for the Sugar Puff Monster? It's like, time for honey, mummy, or something.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it is.
It's follow me, kids, into the van. Come on, kids, you can run off the diabetes.
In at number, actually, we're going to get to number four, actual number four. Number four, The Wrestler from 2008. Mickey Rourke is a washed-up wrestler who tries to date a stripper, rekindle his relationship with his daughter, and pay the bills with a combination of deli work and hardcore wrestling.
I'm glad that you didn't get those dating and reconnecting mixed up there.
No, he doesn't try to hardcore reconnect with his stripper.
Date his daughter.
No, none of that. But yeah.
This is again, unfortunately, one of the ones I missed, which is horrible because it's a really great film. Just well acted, well shot, just kind of like a faux kind of documentary style, and it's really engaging because of that. And just you guys just get to vent all your wrestler talk.
I was going to say, this is the episode probably where it's truly worn on the sleeve that we're all professional, all are or have been at some point professional wrestling fans and regular watchers.
I am now a professional fan of professional wrestling. I do it.
I thought you were going to say professional wrestler. I thought there was a revelation coming then.
Yeah, I'm not Dick Dastardly. I just picked a cartoon name. I don't know what my ring name would be. Maybe the bear. I don't know. The point is, we did talk about wrestling for most of the... Like, the start of the podcast, we're just, like, mentioning wrestling endlessly yeah. without actually discussing Ram, who is in the film, played by Mickey Rock. Abby, I want to throw to you, because you are our wrestling correspondent, even yeah. though we all like wrestling a bit.
What?
Any thoughts on the podcast, the film?
I didn't like you to ask
me a question. We haven't got time for questions, just thoughts.
Abby, talk about the wrestler.
Say words about Wrestler 2008.
Mickey Rourke has a face like a wrinkly handbag.
Like Jamie just did. Go.
Well, like you said, we spend most of the time talking about wrestling rather than the film, so I just want to get over that the film is very, very good and that we like it for a reason, and that not only is it embraced by the critical community, wrestlers also rate it because it's about as close to real life as you can get in a filmic setting.
Yeah, spot on.
That's really important, I think, because it's such a, even now, and for a long time before that, it was such a misunderstood and bizarre sort of modern carny world that they all live in, and to have that kind of realistic portrayal of what is a really horrible career if you be honest about it, and has ruined a lot of people who don't want to or don't know how to do anything else.
Yeah, they're just kind of...
It's a very sort of gritty...
They're just kind of messed up, muscly carnies who don't know how to not do pantomimes in their real lives.
It's a really honest film in the story and also in the way it's shot and just generally presented. It feels very, sometimes uncomfortably intimate, and you are really sort of following Randy the Ram around as much as possible.
Plus, you get to see some cool wrestling every now and again.
Yeah, and it's just a well-observed film. It's funny, it's sad, it's touching, and Mickey Rourke is perfectly cast.
Yeah,
and this was his big comeback film. Didn't really capitalize that much in the long run on that comeback, but...
What are you talking about? He was the Russian guy in Iron Man 2. I have bird. I have bird. And whip. I have electro whip and bird. I hate Iron Man. And he holds a little chihuahua in that Mexican Johnny Depp disaster that Robert Rodriguez did to sequel to Desperado. Once a Time in Mexico, that's what it's called. He did that. He did loads of films. He's great. He's fine. He's done great. He launched his career again.
I think he also holds a tiny dog a lot of the time in real life.
Yeah, that's a real thing.
And on that note, here's a clip of us talking about The Wrestler. So, Abby, The Wrestler, what's the deal? Do you like wrestling? Do you like working on a meat counter? What is it?
I do heart wrestling, yes. I have worked on a meat counter, but I cannot say that I... Not that I didn't enjoy it, but nor did I enjoy it. It's one of those really great movies that people might not give a chance to because of what it's about.
I was like, look, this weird fake soap opera pantomime for fighters who just, it's the best thing ever. It's the most amazing high and low form of art I've ever seen.
There's so much about this film in terms of the way it treats professional wrestling and in terms of just as a film and as a story. It's so well done.
Like, yeah, it gets it. It gets the world and the people, and that's really quite good considering it's not a documentary.
And I'm glad this film is there, and I'm glad it got the critical acclaim and the recognition it got.
And I'm glad they didn't cast Hulk Hogan as was rumoured, because that would have been terrible.
No, that was Hulk Hogan lying through his teeth. However, it was going to be Nicolas Cage.
That would have been terrible. I would volunteer for a chokeslam off any wrestler, or indeed probably Mickey Rourke. So, continuing our best films we've reviewed. Number 3, and a pause because it's 12 Angry Men. So not 3, 12 Angry Men. That would be wrong. 12 Angry Men from 1957. It's about 12 Angry Men arguing in a room.
That's, yeah.
There is no more plot.
We should also mention there on a jury, so that's kind of why they're getting angry.
It could have been called 12 Angry Jurors, but they went for the obvious.
This was one that I had already seen before, and I wanted to revisit it because I liked it the first time I saw it, but I don't feel like I really appreciated it enough. And I watched it again and this is one that I think is risky to talk too much about, because for a film that is literally 12 sweaty, shouting men in a room in real time, there's so much to talk about, which we, you know, we do in the episode, but there's so much going on in such a small setting. It's one of those films that proves that if you've got the right script and performers, you don't need anything else.
That is true. It well, is I mean, just an easily remarkable film. It is just in the best films you should check out list. So it was an easy one for us to pick as a best film we've reviewed, because it's critically known as being good. So I don't know. We discuss all kinds of aspects of it, including the voice of Piglet. He's in it. The real actor is in it. That's just 12 great actors, and we talk about them all a little bit. And yeah, it's a good one. Anyone else want to say some stuff about The Angry Men's?
Yeah, it's. I think we all ended up really liking it, and it is kind of one of those films that's always in all the books and all the lists of great films. And you know, coming into it, it's like, well, it's just kind of 12 men talking in a room. It can't be that good, but no, it was.
I know, it's so engaging. You end up just getting involved in it. You feel like you're one of them.
Yeah, you go through the process of thinking and sweating and getting tired, and but in a good way, like just you're in the room with them and you feel like you've been in on this argumentative jury. And yeah. I will say, I think one of the messages of the film is old people are not to be trusted with their opinions. They can't see, they don't wear glasses, and let's be honest, they're slightly racist. They see a Latino kid and they just blame him from the get-go. So I think the film is, though it's nice and liberal and about, you know, questioning what is true and what's not, it does suggest old people can't be trusted. Don't you guys think?
Yeah, pretty much.
it just sort of says that, subtly and unsubtly, that old people just, they make up their mind in a snap decision, and then you've got to question that, because they're not always right.
Ageism aside, don't know how long it takes them to get to and from one side of the room.
Yeah, they have no, like, people. Like, anyone who is in a courtroom and gives their opinion, think twice, because chances are they just made it all up and don't know what they're talking about. Yeah, so I like that it sort of is in the 50s, yet it's quite different, you know. It was in the 50s, yet it was questioning the establishment. It was a very, very, like, you know, risky film in a sense. It's very liberal and very un-50s in many ways.
I think it's one of those films that, for anyone who is a younger sort of a burgeoning film buff or whatever, there's a certain avoidance of films that are too old. So you'd see, you know, a top 100 films of all time, and this would be in there, and maybe someone younger would go, oh yeah, but 1957, it's black and white.
And then should say, oh, there's other films other than the Ghostbusters. That's not an old film. This is an old film.
No, yeah, watch it. It's phenomenal. And especially if, you know, you're someone who is interested in something like screenwriting or script writing. You like dialogue and character, pure character and nothing else. Character-driven stories that don't have anything else going on. This is a fantastic example of how to really put together a script that relies on nothing other than the character interactions.
Yeah. Very easy to do as a play as well, if you're a play person.
I think it was a play first.
Abby, any other thoughts? I know you didn't get to speak much there. Do you have anything to add?
I have a... I just have an anecdote.
Go on.
That you reminded me of, but doesn't actually have anything to do with the film. Customers at work keep really annoying me by saying, I've come to look for a film. It's quite old. And then they'll say one that's from, like, 1981. Like, that's not old.
I'm no, sorry. It's
1921
old.
Is old.
No. 1981 is 1921 to people younger than us now.
I want an old film. It's got, I think, some bloke called Seth Rogen in it. Is that him?
Some guy called Bill Murray. I've never heard of him.
Oh, he is actually in fairness now in some old... Anyway, you're right, Abby. It's sad times that we should move on from before we realise how old we are. Clip time. We are going to be four not very angry people discussing the film. 12 angry men. Although, you know, if we have some disagreements, we might get quite heated about it.
That's why I'm a very angry person. Although not a man, so...
We are going to be one angry woman and three calm men discussing the film 12 Angry Men.
It's just like one of those films like you feel like you have to experience at some point, otherwise you can't really think of yourself as like a cinema person or cinemaphile or whatever.
This film is like a Kinder Egg. But it's Kinder Egg.
I swear Kinder Egg is more often than not something we go to on Spoiler Film than metaphor. I endorse it. It's a unanimous guilty of being a great movie. Ah, 12, four happy people all in one podcast, guys. Now let's go outside and not go to the baseball. So, in at number two, best films we've reviewed, Sorcerer from 1977.
Bad spelling and all.
Yes.
One of the few things I don't like about this film is the way that they've just made up a word.
How do you spell sorcerer? Is it like sauce as in you put on a bolognese? Sorcerer.
No, I think it should be sorcerer, and they've gone with sorcerer.
Is it?
Well, it doesn't make sense anyway, because there's no fucking sorcerers in it. Because this film, Roy Scheider plays a criminal, along with three other miscellaneous crooks, attempts to transport explosives through the jungle in two shitty old trucks in order to blow up a fire... to earn his freedom.
Blow up a fire.
That's what he does.
I know. And I don't know if this was done intentionally, but there is a fantastic segue here from one film that I picked to another that sums up my Exorcist obsession. Because we had 12 Angry Men that had Lee J. Cobb, who's Lieutenant Kinderman in The Exorcist, and then you have this, which is directed by William Friedkin.
This is where the kind of running joke of Jamie always choosing films related to The Exorcist kind of really comes to a head. We kind of call him out in podcast.
Maybe in the next seasons, we don't have seasons, in the continuing slog of film chats we do, maybe we should let, because there's a general rule, if the film's really popular, we can't do it because it's boring and there's lots of podcasts out there, they're always reviewing, everyone reviews Die Hard and Indiana Jones, and Exorcist is so big you kind of can't bother reviewing it. But I think if we'd have let Jamie review Exorcist, he wouldn't have come up with so many interesting choices like this.
That's actually true, yeah.
We wouldn't have forced him, right, I want to talk about Exorcist, but I have to do that by mentioning other films that people are in that are connected, and then do it that way. Like, you could probably piece together an Exorcist review across all of our podcasts that Jamie
picks. Yeah, I've managed to crowbar it because I got the ninth configuration in there somewhere in our archive.
Yep.
That championship season, because it was written by Jason Miller, who was Father Karras.
Yeah. There's just a lot, every now and again, there's a connection, and that is an excuse for Jamie to talk about his favourite film of all time. But now, we should talk about Sorcerer and why it's great. And it's great in its own right, because it's just unexpectedly tense, brilliant. It's literally just trucks, the jungle. My favourite bit is there's a naked man dancing to distract the drivers for some reason. He's just dicking around, and there's every kind of peril, from naked men to cliffs to rickety bridges to other people. There's even a weird assassin man who I think kills a Nazi to take the place of him, and it's great. It's like really tense and exciting and brilliant. Anyone else, any memories from Sorcerer?
Again, unfortunately, one of the podcasts I've missed. I seems like I've missed all the really good films.
You saw the film, though, didn't you?
Yeah, no, I've seen all the films, and yeah, I agree. This is by far one of the best films that we've seen, and just kind of, I don't know why it's not more known. This is one of William Friedkin's best movies.
It was a really, really troubled shoot, and then the studio butchered it before it came out, and it's never been released until, I think, either this year or the year before, 2016 or 15, his actual cut has never been released until they re-release it on DVD and Blu-ray, and he supervised the remaster and the cut. And he's so passionate about it that he is actually on Amazon giving one-star reviews to the previous edits under his actual name, saying, "This is not my version." But yeah, it had a really troubled shoot and then a really troubled release, and it kind of got buried. because of studio interference, and it's only recently that it's been released in, you know, what he considers its true form, which is why I wanted to watch it, because, you know, I'm a huge fan of The Exorcist, and I've heard of this, and wanted to finally see it, and it was really fucking good.
It still does my nothing that Sorcerer isn't the one that makes it.
Yeah, of the two vans, it's the other one with a slightly weird name.
About it, though. There's so much... I'm starting to learn that I like films with simple plots that do a lot outside of their story.
Looking at the list of what we got, I think all of the films in our top five best films involve in some way sweaty men. Because this, the men are sweating from Jungle Heat.
Well,
12 Angry Men sweat. The wrestler is wrestling, so he's sweating. And then Manhunter is, you know, it's tense. And then Strange Days is probably the only one.
All of my notorious, terrible picks in the past, three out of our five top films are actually my choices. 12 Angry Men, Sorcerer, and the next one.
Yeah, you sort of reached a point where you felt like you really needed to redeem yourself. You were quite a low ebb.
Like Rock and Roll, the thing is, Super Mario Brothers, you also picked those films.
Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. Whenever I pick a good film or a bad film, I knock it out of the park either way. But yeah, Sorcerer was great. Full of sweaty men, you know, I know what I like.
But yeah,
like, I mean, the next pick and like 12 Angry Men, it's a simple story with a lot going on.
Yeah, they are. You like them simple. I believe your general opinion on films is, I like a film where they just explain everything to you for ages. Just exposition dumps the movie.
No,
this isn't the case in this. This is just good, simple movie. It's great. Trucks and dirt and jungle and blood and explosions and fire.
And some fantastic hallucinatory sequences towards the end as well, where shit gets kind of spooky.
It does. It gets proper weird. You like that too. And what I like about this is it's a good allegory for kind of... I won't spoil it. We'll spoil it in the spoiler-filled film conversation we had. If you want to know what it was, listen to that.
All of that stuff and Roy Scheider's fantastic craggy face.
That's great.
Like an old leather shoe.
Yes. So, I think we'll have a clip now of JB probably saying some of the same things he said the first time round.
Hopefully there's some of me talking about The Exorcist in the clip as well.
I can't remember, but it's only a minute, so boom.
There it would be very difficult to find one where you don't.
Sorcerer. And it's not about a magical wizard or mage or anything like that. It's not supernatural in any way. So throw those misconceptions in the bin. Two trucks, four guys, and a shit ton of explosives. Let's travel through the worst road imaginable, through the jungle.
One of my least expected hurdles of this journey was just some local guy in a loincloth titting about.
That's true.
I loved that was the first challenge that they came up against. this guy just going, hey, truck for ages.
It's Jamie's pick, that's why he's so informed and anxious to get talking. And the reason Jamie picked it, I shall tell you, is because he's obsessed with all things Exorcist. And it's almost like every film he will ever suggest has to some way link back to The Exorcist. So
you are officially worse than me in Highlander.
Hello, sausage.
So, in at number one, our favourite film we've talked about as a podcast, Dredd. Or Dredd. 2005. That's the Welsh pronunciation of it.
Sylvester Stallone vehicle. Oh, no, sorry.
No. Dredd from 2012.
Does star Rob Schneider.
Oh, dear. But this one is...
a good one.
Yes. And it's Carl Urban is a futuristic cop / judge. Because it's just the name they call the cops. They're cops, really. But he's a futuristic cop consisting mostly of a helmet and a chin who violently takes down a tower block full of baddies with his sexy telepathic cop/judge in training with his cool gun that does whatever you say it will.
This is one of the rare films where it's the remake that nobody asked for and then liked.
Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say it was... It's not a remake.
No, but it is...
It's another attempt at adapting Judge Dredd after the catastrophic Sylvester Stallone 95 version. But that the existence of the Sylvester Stallone pile of shit, unfortunately, I think, hurt this version when it came out in 2012 at the box office, because no fucker went to see it, and it just quietly disappeared from the cinema. And then, it had a huge resurgence when it came out on DVD and Blu-ray. But unfortunately, the studio still didn't see.
Yeah, we had hopes. We had hope for a sequel at the time, and now we've subsequently realized it's
there are rumblings now of it possibly getting a Netflix follow-up series, which would be fun, and it's perfect for it.
Yeah.
And especially now that you've got stuff like Ash vs. Evil Dead, where it's having a TV resurgence.
And it's from a very good comic book. It's like one of the few British sci-fi comic books, and it's great. Dredd the comics.
Tons, like, with how well they did Dredd, and how again, it's another simple story. It's just Die Hard. It's some people trapped in a tower.
The thing that happened at the time is it came out the same time as The Raid, which is another great film, but that's also policemen trapped in a tower block killing baddies.
It was one of the weirdest coincidences, because they genuinely just happened to come out at the same time and have similar plots for no reason. But
and they're both great, so it's a shame they were so similar.
I think Dredd is definitely a film, for people who do like action movies, but it's also very short, and it's got a sense of humor about itself, but it's very subtle. It doesn't beat you over the head with ooh, satire or anything. It's just funny in the same way over-the-top 80s action movies were funny when they became self-aware.
Like, Dredd is a little bit sarcastic, but it's not on the nose. And he's kind of like Batman, but almost, he's kind of cooler than Batman, because he doesn't dress up like a lunatic, and it's actually his job to take down criminals.
Also, Carl Urban is phenomenal as Judge Dredd, and doesn't take his fucking helmet off.
I know.
Yeah.
That's the best thing about it.
And it's got, is it Lena Headey? I don't know how to say her name. The one who's in Game of Thrones.
Mama.
I've got this thing at work where a lot of the world cinema has like Mama in the title and that kind of thing, but every time I see one, I go Mama because of this film.
But she's brilliant. Like she's a fantastic villain in this.
And it's nice to have another. She's just kicking ass as women villains now, because she's nailed Game of Thrones and is the best. And then in Dredd, she's again. It's good to have a female proper villain. And considering Dredd is so manly and machismo, and it's good that he has his sidekick, which is a lady as well. It really stops it from being full of just sweaty men all but wall to wall.
But it's also it's got so many lines in it that you can quote, and it's got enough characters with slightly over the top silly ways of talking that make it fun to do impressions, like Judge Dredd himself. Yeah. And it's got a great sort of almost John Carpenter-esque synth soundtrack. It actually does feel sort of like a John Carpenter film. Like it reminds like Assault on Precinct 13 and stuff like that. And now I think this film was kind of a precursor to Mad Max Fury Road. There's a similarity between them both. They've got the same sort of self-aware sense of humor and the same briskness and simplicity and speed.
And even style as well, like, kind of similarly styled.
They're very similar films. I think if Dredd was exactly like it was, but had come out after the success of Mad Max, it would have done a lot better at the box office.
Maybe. Anthony, I want to hear from you a little bit, please.
What's left to say? I mean, it's just a great film. It's got like the best of 80s action films. It's also really got a really modern feel as well. Intense action, gory. It uses 3D in an interesting way, and just as very few films actually do that these days. And here's one where it actually takes 3D and takes it to a different level and actually makes it work for the story.
Yeah, they come up with a gimmick that makes it perfectly good, that they slow it down and show it really dramatic. Like, they have really great scenes, but it's all to do with the plot of the slow-mo drug, and that's a tick box I like, bothering to justify this, things.
It's also a very good introduction to kind of Judge Dredd, just because I know it gets quite insane in the comics, and this is a very, very kind of low-key-ish like introduction to Judge Dredd, that works really well.
It's great because it's an origin story without actually being a full-on origin story. It's just a great start to what could have been a fantastic franchise.
It's amazing. Check it out. It's great. Dredd.
It's a short film. It's a really like simple story, but you feel like there's a whole world going on outside.
There is a texture to it, yeah.
It's a very ambitious role for someone to take. As an actor, going into a film where you're essentially not seen is quite a risk and hard to pull off.
There's usually a deal-breaker thing in it for me. And in this, it was whether or not whoever they got could do Dreadface. And he could.
It does have all the adult stuff that a 12-year-old boy wants from a film.
Yeah.
And, you know, they kind of have to make do with Harry Potter and Twilight. And I feel sorry. They need more, like, Terminators and Robocops and stuff. And this is a kind of a more modern-day version of that. It is both the thinking man's action movie and the brain-dead man's action movie.
This is one of those, like, usually when we pick a bad film, that's when there's so much to talk about. But there is so much to talk about with this.
Oh, he does talk like a bag of gravel in Clint Eastwood's mouth. So, let's get the good bit going, guys. Let's talk about the worst. Oh, because basically he's patting the back of all these films.
Some of mine are in here as well.
Mine too.
Everyone's represented, I think. Maybe not Abby. Nothing. No, Abby's not handed us anything completely awful. Thank you, Abby.
I just realised, you know,
I was just going to say, it's because I watch these films before I pitch them to you guys.
I do as well, but I also am sadistic.
You know how I was bragging about three of the five top best were mine. Three of the worst are also mine.
Yeah, you're the best and the worst.
So, like I said, knock it out of the park every time.
Yeah. And so, our top five worst films we've reviewed, brackets, ones that actually made us angry. Because there's so many bad films we love. But these are ones we're just like, oh, this is so terrible. So genuinely the worst.
Yeah, like, there's a really broad definition of bad films. Because, B-movies, they're so bad they're fun or whatever. And also, films that try to be those films, like all that shit, like Sharknado and fucking bollocks that I will never watch. But these films, I think when you say ones that made us angry, these are the kind of films that make you feel physically sick when you try and get through them. And that you end the film wanting to like pull out your own teeth.
Maybe so. So I had some fun chatting about them, but they are pretty terrible.
Oh, no. The conversation afterwards is great, but the actual experience,
it's hard going.
It's, yeah.
Don't watch some of these films
alone.
It's
like the reward.
Sit with a buddy. I recommend everyone who enjoys the bad films, you need someone next to you to vent your anger with. And that's how
also,
you should approach them.
A couple of these, while we are slagging them off that much, they will have people that will defend them because Legend is kind of considered.
Don't skip ahead, you spoilery cunt. That's not. Right. Don't spoil the spoiler filled film conversation.
All right, I'll get onto that when we get onto it.
It'll be just after it's number four, so we'll get to it.
Okay.
In at number five, Electric Dreams from 1984.
Squandered. That's going to be a word we use a lot.
It's going to be a word that is in my very blurb. Lenny von Doland, you're to blame, is a dorky architect who accidentally creates artificial life and then squanders it by using the newly living computer to compose tasteless pop songs in order to seduce his dunderheaded, cello-playing neighbour.
Also, we had to watch this fucking shit twice.
Yep,
we did. Because technology rebelled against us because of how much we hated the film.
And how apt it is for technology to rebel on such a topic. We did it once, and then we did it almost a year later because the edit didn't work and it was fucked and we had a bit missing. And now we get to say how awful it is all over again. Anthony, I believe it was your choice, so maybe you can start us off with your thoughts.
I want to touch her.
Oh, yeah. Originally, when I first brought this up, like, the first time I saw it, I thought it was one of those kind of so bad it's good films.
No.
but since then, I've seen it countless times, and it just gets worse and worse with every viewing. And I feel like the gap that we took kind of helped us save up a lot of bile for this film when it all came out, yeah. When we did the review. But yeah, it's just one of those films that's like incredibly 80s and schlocky, and it's essentially just an extended music video montage that they're passing off as a film.
It's one of the two on the worst five list that is, you know how we said that Manhunter is a great example of really of its time 80s filmmaking, and then this and the number one on this worst list are two great examples of its time 80s filmmaking at its absolute worst.
Mm. And both of them my first choices.
Yeah. That's, yeah.
You're a connoisseur.
yeah, I just realised all the worst choices are just you and me. Says a lot.
Well, here's the thing with it. I think Electric Dreams is fantastic because I hate it so much. Like, the concept pisses me off because it endlessly squanders the concept of a computer that's come to life. Miles, who gets called Moles by the computer, is a complete prick. Unrelatable. He takes his girlfriend or future girlfriend to Alcatraz, as a nice day trip, and he just doesn't understand. I mean, the whole film doesn't understand technology, but a hilarious level of what the fuck.
It doesn't understand technology or human relationships.
Yeah, or plot or logic or emotions.
Likeable characters.
I think it's awful. Abby, come on, you must have something to say.
Oh, yeah, it's a massive stupid pile of shit, this one.
But it's, again, it's one of those ones, part of what makes you so angry when you watch it is every now and again you realise there's a concept for a good film in there. Mm. And they just
explode
balls it up from start to finish. Yeah.
I'm trying to think, like, I'm going to have a metaphor because that's something that we like to do.
It is.
And I want one where it's kind of like someone has used... Oh, I know what I can do. Someone's used a flux capacitor as a Christmas tree decoration. So they have the concept of time travel, but they've just used it for a flashy light on a tree.
That looks nice. Hopefully, yeah. I can seduce my neighbour with such a decorative tree.
I have my own version of metaphor, which is somebody has used your toilet in the middle of the night and not flushed it. Not only that, you've gotten up in the morning and discovered it, and there are no guests staying in your house, so who the fuck was it?
And why didn't your computer automatically control the toilet and flush it like you set it up to?
Oh, God, this is a bad film.
It's a good podcast, though, one of my favourites. But it's
if you want to hear us get furious and like more angry as it goes on as well, especially because we had to do it twice.
Mm. So yeah, it's worthy of the worst. But let's move on. Here's a clip of us chatting.
I'm exhausted already. We haven't even started talking about this yet.
Well, in fairness to you, we've covered this ground before because we have already attempted to review this week's film, Electric Dreams, and we put off the redo for a while. We finally went, you know what, we should do it. We're not going to be defeated. We bloody watched it. We've watched Electric Dreams again, probably about a year on. And
I was going to say, we had to give it a year's gap to try it again.
So Electric Dreams is a self-proclaimed fairy tale for computers, whatever that means.
On paper, this sounds very intriguing, but it's not.
It's such an 80s yuppie way of creating life. I suppose they couldn't have been like, they couldn't have sprinkled it with cocaine, but like, I suppose the next one down is just champagne.
This film is many confused ideas, none of which are capitalized on and don't fit together in a coherent way. So they've made a film. On a technical level, it's a film, but in no way, shape or form is it actually pleasing functionally.
In at number four, Legend from 1985, not the one that came much later on and is about a British pair of twin gangsters played by one man. Not that one. Legend from 85. A young Tom Cruise, with the aid of many stupid-looking dwarfs, tries to stop Tim Curry, who is playing a giant red plasticky-looking devil thing that likes killing unicorns and has stolen his girlfriend. True or false? That's my balderdash blueprint.
Okay, this was my pick because I like Ridley Scott a lot.
I don't like
it. And I like Blade Runner is one of my favourite films. Not quite The Exorcist, but it's one of my favourite films. And it is one of those films that I remember from when I was a kid, but pretty much the only thing I remember about it is Tim Curry as a big, muscular demon thing.
He is the only thing worth remembering about it.
Yeah, I kind of thought, because I like Ridley Scott's films when he's allowed to just go insane. Like Prometheus is a really good example. It's a really divisive film. And it's not great, but it's so crazy and pretty that I enjoy it. And I kind of thought Legend was going to be the same thing, because from trailers, that's what it looks like. But it turns out that beyond a couple of scenes and everything involving Tim Curry, the rest of the film's weirdly kind of drab and just sort of shit-looking.
Well, it's super ugly on purpose a lot of the time. Like, I think I spent the whole podcast coming up with creative ways to say there are hideous characters and they looked awful.
Yeah, it's so hard to like anyone in the film other than Tim Curry, because he's just devouring the scenery in pistols.
He's amazing, but the lack of motivation for anyone, like Tom Cruise, we don't know who he is and why. We don't know why anyone's... Everything's just get the MacGuffin, get the MacGuffin, get the MacGuffin, save the unicorns, defeat the devil, save the day. And they don't even bother to unfreeze humanity, which they set up very early on.
Yeah. This is... Okay, you know how we were talking about the top three best and how simplicity is part of what makes them so good?
Yeah.
I guess this is the other end of the scale where there's too little happening and you have nothing to, you don't really have anything to latch on to.
You don't know why anyone's doing anything.
It's like, okay, this is all happening, but I don't care. The only characters in it are really kind of annoying and unlikable, and I don't want to be involved. I don't want to go on this journey with them. I'd rather be hanging out with Tim Curry and his dining table.
Yeah, I mean, that whole his whole setup, the weird devil Tim Curry thing, it's just, let's just all be about that. Let's stay with him. He can be camp and exuberant and evil and kill as many unicorns as he likes. And there is that quite a good scene where the female protagonist is turned into an evil version, and it's kind of cool and done well, but then it sort of gets back to Tom Cruise and his ugly
friends.
That's
what I mean. With this film... The stuff with Tim Curry is, I think he's just called, like, isn't he called the Darkness or the Lord of Darkness? He's never actually defined as the devil, but
giant
whatever.
Giant hemorrhoid thing.
Yeah. All the scenes with him in his lair or whatever, all that stuff's really well shot. It looks really good. It's interesting. But it's like Ridley Scott and the audience are bored with all the other stuff going on in the film.
Abby, what would you say about Legend?
If I remember correctly, this was a bit of a passion project, was it?
Kind of. Like, he wanted to do something like this, and he obviously didn't have any ideas.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. It made me realise that somebody needs to have a very firm hand on Ridley Scott's shoulder when he's making things, so every now and again they can lean in and go,
yeah,
no,
don't do that. Yeah, he will. He's very much he's very independent is the impression I've had I know there are a lot of stories from the set of Blade Runner about he can be quite difficult to work with because he has a very clear idea of what he wants to do.
Unless it's the plot of Legend, then he just you're right, though. His auteurship is his own problem,
yeah,
in a sense.
Yeah, it's a problem with any director that has a fiercely unique vision of anything. because it means that sometimes they'll come out with something absolutely phenomenal, which is entirely them. But then a film or two films later, they'll come out with something that's complete shit and is entirely them.
Yeah.
It's a bit like your choices, Jamie.
Yes. I like the directors I like. I feel I can relate to them. Sometimes they'll knock it out of the park. Either way.
Anthony, do you want to shed some light on your take on Legend?
Yeah, this film was a total surprise because it's a very well-known film by Ridley Scott and people like look back on it fondly, but it is just an incomprehensible piece of crap. it's heavily edited. Like, I'm pretty sure when we watched it, none of us watched the same version of this film.
Yeah.
Really kind of confusing, and it was just so ugly and bad, and like the main female actress, God, I hated her so much.
I feel sorry for you, Anthony, because you watched this film for both versions as extra sort of punishment.
I watched the original and the theatrical cut to kind of see the differences. And to be fair, the kind of like director's cut is a little bit better because there's more in there and it's a little less confusing. But it still has a lot of the same problems as the original theatrical cut.
The major problem with this film is that for something so potentially or seemingly imaginative, it's just kind of boring.
It's like kind of bad time for fantasy films in general.
Before they had their renaissance with Lord of the Rings. I couldn't look at it though. It was boring and unpleasant to watch. I mean, it's so even Tim Curry, who's good, we can admit that, he still just looks like a minotaur has had all of his fur burnt off and then he's been hit with an iron a few times. I want to be sick looking at it, but it was so unpleasant.
Off balance. Again, we were talking about this the other day, where it's like, you can't make everyone ugly, then that's the new normal. In order for these guys to be ugly, these guys have to be beautiful.
Yeah, it was like someone had melted some Skittles into some vomit, and I was meant to enjoy the rainbow effect. They all look like evil Toby Jugs.
You're right, he does very much look like if Aleister Crowley had bought himself a Toby Jug.
It looks like if five penises and a vagina were trying to fight their way out of your face. And his face is just like someone has poured wax over a jack-o'-lantern and then gone to town on it. Horrible. It was a terrible film. And I watched some terrible films this week.
I felt like they were giving their best, but like it was doomed to fail.
In at number 3, Road to Wellville. I think, unfortunately, Anthony missed this one again.
Not unfortunately. I usually catch up on the ones that I don't see, but this one, I've listened to the podcast and I really do not want to watch this film.
Yeah.
But just for clarity, this is The Road to Wellville from 1994. Anthony Hopkins is Dr. Kellogg. Yes, he is from the family that invented the cereal. Only this Kellogg is more interested in running a quirky health spa with all kinds of dopey treatments and remedies that are supposed to help his horned-up patrons, but mostly they just exacerbate their libidos.
Yeah, let's not ignore the fact that most of these cures involve bowels or
bums,
sex.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and it's... this was my choice, and I don't know what the fuck it is.
I heard that Dr. Kellogg actually, in trying to stop people masturbating, actually invented loads of masturbatory aids by accident.
Yeah, I think this is maybe sort of based on reality-ish, but it's just this weird, like, sex-not-comedy romp. Like, I don't... Who is this for? Like, what's the audience?
I don't think we came to a conclusion in the podcast. I mean, check it out if you want to. But I think we were like, what the hell? It's like a sex comedy, but it's a farce, and it's sort of historical, but it sort of gets sidetracked as to what's truth and what's funny. And all of it's just, what the hell?
If I remember right, our general consensus of the film was, like that was kind of the conclusion.
Two types of what the hell, and that's disgusting.
Yeah, and also, if you're going to make, like, an attempt to make a sexy comedy, don't cast fucking Matthew Broderick in the lead.
And don't squander Anthony Hopkins in what is the weirdest half-racist Chinese cartoon, half... what was it? It was. He looked like the Kentucky Fried Chicken Colonel and the Chinese stereotype doctor thing. It was weird.
I will say, pretty much the only redeeming feature of this film is Anthony Hopkins in this bizarre performance. Because at least he is kind of going all out with it.
He's watchable because you can't see how they convinced Anthony Hopkins to do such an awful job. Such a miserable character.
It was just shit and weird. And Cole Meany turns up, shoving his fingers at women for no reason. Oh, I don't like,
well, for fun. But yeah, Meany shouldn't be doing naughty things to ladies.
I don't want to see all these funny-looking people in sexcapades.
Yeah, all the cast, you're like, I don't feel comfortable seeing you talk about sex in this unsettling way.
I'm sure Cole Meany has, you know...
fun.
He's a married man. Funnily enough, one of my friends was neighbours with him for a long time.
I won't ask. I won't ask.
Oh, yeah, there was... Well, as far as I know, there were no, you know...
Kellogg-based
style shenanigans. There might have been. I'll have to ask him and I'll report back. But, but it's one of those films that has a lot of sex in it and is really grossly unsexy and just weird.
True. Abby, you loved this, though, didn't you?
I found this film almost entirely repellent.
I reckon you probably... I think you would have this on your the worst.
Oh, yeah. I just... it just endlessly found new ways to disgust me.
And you're not a prude, it's just they're so bad, the jokes, aren't they?
I think that's the thing, it's that... That's the most insulting thing about it, is that it's not even funny.
It's funny if you're a prude, and this sort of stuff is titillating and shocking. Ooh.
Sorry, uninvited guests.
It's okay. Speaking of uninvited guests, I should mention, we have had a guest on the past who was invited, and his name was Tom, and he joined us for a couple of episodes, and he joined us on Robot Jocks and maybe Summer Wars, and thanks, Tom. We enjoyed chatting with you, but, you know, now we've found our groove with the four of us, but I thought we'd mention Tom, seeing as Anthony's family walking in on him. He gave me the idea to mention we've had guests in the past.
Yes, a general salute to all the people who had been here in the past.
Yeah, you're all great. We love chatting with
you guys. You're missed.
And thanks for the choices. Some great films chosen.
I was just going to add to the repellent nature of the film that Abby was talking about, because that's a very good word for it. And again, I don't think any of us are particularly prudish or reserved when it comes to stuff like that. It's just that the way the film does it is not funny. It's just gross. It made my skin crawl. Mm.
Yeah. Anthony, do you have anything you want to add to the film you didn't watch?
Sounds lame.
It was.
It was shit.
And I don't want to watch it. I'm sorry.
Yeah, don't. Goes out to anyone listening as well. If you haven't seen it, don't bother.
Do listen to us talk about it, because that's great. Here's some clips from our show.
Oh, yeah. I will say that, like, out of everybody, I think John Cusack and Michael Lerner's pair are my favourite characters. Like, they were the ones I actually... cared about for the most part.
Well, I think it's because they're in the more interesting part, which isn't about a stupid health spa that's obsessed with excrement jokes and sex jokes. Because they're in a bit about, you know, swindling and being poor and trying to, you know, make a rival brand of cereals. So that's, you know, fine. But the other story is just about repressedness and how amusing bottoms and boobies are. Ho, ho, ho. Isn't it funny when people are going to think about sex or want to, and then Dr. Kellogg stops them or something, and then straps them into a machine that jiggles them in some way? Ha, ha, ha. You know, he's a big Freudian bag of problems, and yet he's in the position to, you know, suggest to people that...
inflict that on other people.
Yeah, exactly. To tell people his quackpot theories and enforce them with his weird contraptions. It is then obsessed with doing a raunchy comedy that may as well have been called Carry On Up the Kellogg or something.
Oh, is it a sex comedy? Nope. I'm good.
In at number 2, Exorcist 2, The Heretic, from 1977. Richard Burton plays a priest who, needlessly and inexplicably, mind-melds with the now completely well girl who is possessed in the first film, and somehow stirs up demons and trouble in Africa, which somehow results in James Earl Jones dressing up as a locust.
Yeah. Remember how we were talking about how The Exorcist is my favourite film?
Yeah.
Of all time. I've seen every sequel. This is one of the films that has been discussed all over the internet, which is something we try and avoid. But this isn't like Legend or Road to Wildville or other shitty films that we've done that are just kind of boring. Because this film is like a fever dream. It's like John Borman, while he was directing it, had a massive stroke or some kind of mental breakdown. And I don't know, I don't really have the words for how strange, stupid, and insane this film is.
Does anyone else feel like they can articulate what it is about The Exorcist 2 that is quite so frustrating?
I think a big part of it is just how insanely different it is from the first one.
Well, this is what I was going to say. One of the reasons I like The Exorcist so much is that it is such an obviously unrealistic concept, the idea of demon possession and all that stuff, presented in a very sort of grounded, almost documentary way by William Friedkin. It's one of the things that makes the film what it was at the time. The reason it was so disturbing at the time is because it felt like it was actually happening. Like, it was very sedate for the most part. You've got Exorcist 2 within the same decade, which has fucking dream machines that let you share dreams with other people.
Yeah, it's weird. And why? Why does this priest bloke think he can just waltz in and be like, fuck it, give me the machine, I know what I'm doing, I'll mess with the psyche of this girl.
Yeah!
It's crazy.
Richard Burton, possibly at his most alcoholic in this film.
In a room made of glass hexagons, with children foam hexagons around. It's just a baffling opening.
Everything about it is baffling. The whole film is baffling. The music, the screaming.
Oh, the sound of locusts, maybe, when they're singing.
And the kid who would ward off the locusts in Africa, and he gets possessed and goes, "I am Paluzu," and it's like, what? Why?
Just do a film about exorcism in Africa, if that's what takes your fantasy. Don't confuse the plot with Reagan and ruin a young woman's life who's already better. Baffling.
Yeah, stuff. Why bring her back? Why set Sharon on fire? Why? Yeah.
Oh, dear. Abby, if I could just ask you, is there any words you would use other than baffling, which I think we've all used now, that you'd use to describe The Exorcist 2?
Betrayal. But I think I did it in the podcast as well, but I'm going to do it again. I want to talk about Exorcist 2 via Highlander 2, because they did exactly the same thing to different franchises. They went, remember the first one? Fuck the first one.
Yeah.
It is vomit-inducing in that 360 head spin way with green sick. It makes everyone who watches it do that, which is the only way it connects to the first film. I mean, just, why is this so terrible? How did it get made? Why? Please stop. Like, that's how
it's a sequel to a film, one of many sequels to a film that never really needed a sequel, and is the first one, and immediately shits all over the original and anything good about it. But it does have Richard Burton going, "The flames."
Richard Burton is amazing.
Yeah, he is fantastically terrible in this. And, he's one of the best actors that Wales ever produced. He's one of those actors that, like, Welsh people are, Richard Burton is a classic Welsh actor.
That's right.
And, you know, we're all deeply proud of Richard Burton, but he's done some shit. He was also in Candy, which we did.
Yeah,
I was going to bring up Candy. As did the exact same thing again, of him being the best thing in a pile of shit.
Yeah, but also still being terrible in it. Because let's not pretend that he's actually good in this film. He's as shit as everything else. It's just that he, being the theatrical actor he is, goes for the shitness.
If you're going to be in rubbish, be the best rubbish in it.
Exactly. Well, yeah. And he might
fair
not.
Play.
Well, Anthony, do you have anything you wish to add to the Heretic?
It's just so bad. Like, in terms of the gap between original movie and sequel in terms of quality, I think this is probably like one of the biggest drop-offs that has ever existed. I mean, wow, this film, like, what's to say? It's baffling. Perfect word.
I would almost say maybe watch it just to see how badly to follow something up. It's fascinating. Like, it's a fascinating disaster.
It's a kind of mind fuck.
Yeah. It's a kind of mind fuck.
I have a fundamental problem with The Exorcist 2 that pretty much started off all the other problems I have with this movie. And that's that Regan was absolutely fine. They insisted that she wasn't well, and they messed with her and started all of this madness.
Yep.
She was fine.
I'm sorry, I have to get this out of the way. They messed with her with a hypnosis machine that lets you leap into other people's dreams like Sam Beckett.
What both of us didn't get, actually, when we were watching it, is that when Regan and the Doctor were in it, I understood that. But how were they still inside Regan's head when it was the Doctor and Richard Burton?
Yeah, and why? Like, they bring Richard Burton in, and they sit this priest who they've just met down and basically go, right, you sit there and you leap into this teenage girl's mind. This traumatised teenage girl, you untrained priest who you've just met.
Well, the first time, he just insists on doing it himself anyway.
And, you know, that's the other thing as well, straight away. Richard Burton, Father Lamont, is the most unlikable main character priest.
And the best worst film we've reviewed, brackets, ones that actually make us angry, is Xanadu from 1980, and it was Anthony's fault / pick.
No, it was my fault. Didn't say it.
it features Michael Beck as it's okay, he's alright once in The Warriors. It features Michael Beck as a douchebag commercial artist that is inspired by Olivia Newton-John, who roller skates around a lot and is a goddess or something, and she inspires him to open up a ridiculous nightclub with the financial backing from a mad construction mogul in the form of Gene Kelly. All singing, all dancing Gene Kelly pays an artist idiot to open a nightclub because of a muse? Yeah, I think that's right.
Jesus Christ. I'm still angry about this one.
Yeah, I think Abby said at the beginning, like, she's not on this list because she watched the films beforehand. Unfortunately, I don't have that luxury. I knew exactly what I was bringing to the table, and
I think Abby likes us, though. The other reason she doesn't pick terrible films. She likes us all. You're horrible.
But, like, this film, like, it's kind of got an interesting backstory.
He's trying to justify it again. I think he tried this in the podcast. We were like, well, it's got some go on.
No,
Abby,
I stick by that. It's had potential that, again, it totally squandered. It's infamously one of the worst films ever made, because it was the inspiration for, like, the Golden Raspberries. And, like, the film that inspired the Golden Raspberries must have been worth bringing up in this podcast. I think it was.
It's the most slapshod, cocaine-filled rubbish that anyone has ever put together. And it's magically beautiful. And it's just a magical 80s pile of nothing that can be explained. It's baffling again, but also so much happens in it. There's rollerblading and music, and there's almost some good moments. I will agree, there are some music bits where they blend genres together. That just ruins it by going on forever and having no reason for it or making no sense. I don't know, it's weird. Gene Kelly's actually good in it.
Well, I was going to say, there's two things about this film that actually make it worse than it already is, because they add an element of sadness to it. One, it was supposed to be Olivia Newton-John's breakout leading role film.
Because Grease wasn't good enough.
Good fucking job with that one. And two, it was Gene Kelly's last film.
Yep.
I mean,
and he's good. Oh, he dances, and he's not even trying, and he bashes out a dance better than anyone.
He's the only fucker in this whole disaster of a film that is in any way endearing or entertaining, and the whole time you're thinking, why are you in this, Gene?
Also, his character, why are you in this? You're an old man playing a clarinet. Why have you befriended this artist asshole and then have given him loads of money to do your dream of opening up a very, very terrible club?
Sorry, last time I'm saying baffling. After we got done watching this, I put on my tiny shorts and my roller skates and I went out and sadly roller skated around thinking about things.
Oh, I hope you did.
Yes.
The film is all kind of tied together in its awfulness, though, by like, the main guy. Like, both the character and the actor just being absolutely appalling.
Yeah. He's only got the Warriors to his name now. He's like, that's the only thing he's ever done right. And
I thought you would say he denies he was ever in Xanadu. Oh, Michael Beck, weren't you in Xanadu? No. I've never even heard. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, he should deny it. Abby, well, Xanadu, memories and feelings and thoughts.
If I only think about the music, I'm okay.
Well, ELO are great.
As soon as I think about anything that wasn't the music, I just get a bit upset and sad.
When you say think about the music and everything's okay, are you thinking of that point at the end where everyone's roller skating around going, Xanadu, and clapping, Xanadu, and clapping, Xanadu,
well,
clapping.
Yeah.
Over and
but
over again.
But in context, like, the rest of the music, acceptable-ish. And then that end one, it's like, oh, this is the last one. Okay.
The promise of freedom.
The last music just keeps going.
And they have this club. I think we debated it at the time. But it was just, you have a club that's a nightclub where people are meant to pay to come in. But there's seemingly no patrons. Everyone is part of the singing and dance act. And they're on rollerblades and they're in costumes. And there's so many dancers and singers. And it's so colourful and over the top. It's like, well, who's paying for this? Like, who is coming to see this? You're taking up all of the space with your ridiculous dancers. And
there's also...
You rehearsed a different musical number to this. Sorry, Jamie, go on.
There's a conversation with Zeus.
Oh my god, that's right. There's some inexplicable nonsense where people jump through graffiti and end up in a twilight zone where they talk to God in like Tron land, and there's a long conversation between Zeus and like the main goddess. I don't know. Olivia Newton-John is Neon and has some bullshit chat with Zeus, and it doesn't, I'm not talking about it anymore.
Yeah, no,
just no.
Here is us talking about it at the time, and then it'll be on to the faves.
This film alone was the inspiration for the Golden Raspberry Awards being made.
And how many suicides though?
We collectively, as spoiler films, but also individually as people, have all seen some really terrible films. Mm-hmm. But like, for me personally, this was something else entirely.
On the surface, when you just hear about what it is, you think you've found a unicorn or something. Yeah. Yeah. Well, then you watch it and go, no, I found the leprechaun from Leprechaun.
But there's no script. The director doesn't know what he's doing. The cinematographer might as well be asleep.
The lead guy was so bad.
Yeah, his delivery just made me want to strangle him.
Oh, the bit where he's like, it's amazing that it was made in 1980 and is the worst film of the 80s. That's quite an achievement.
Ha 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 ha. What an amusing conversation we were having. But I'm afraid that's the end of part one. We've decided to split the episode into two because it was getting a bit unwieldy. Unwieldy? Unwieldy? Whatever. Anyway, part two will be uploaded shortly after this one, where you can listen to us talk about our favourite episodes we've done thus far. So that just leaves me to say goodbye. Goodbye!